Time now for our weekly political panel, and we're joined by RNZ's political editor, Joe Moyer, and political reporter, Katie Scotcher. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Kia ora.
All right, there has been a lot of stories, and they keep coming, about public service cuts. Joe, I'm interested in how the government is handling this. You get the sense that they've lost the narrative a little bit on this, but they are pushing back to try and convince people that, you know, put this into proportion, sort of the cuts up after a big growth in the public service. How do you think they are fearing?
Yeah, there's certainly that feel of a pushback going on. I mean, it's hard not for them to push back when you've got these headlines coming through, bang, 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 you know, dark day, 1,000 here, we're up to, what, over 3,000 total now public servants that have lost their jobs. So not an easy one for the government to navigate. Also, it's going to be the budget day before we get a sense of a lot of this, which, of course, is not until May the 30th. So it's a long time for them to be fighting fires on this as well. The reason we have to wait until budget day is because that is when it will become clear how much of this money that's been saved and back office support stuff is actually going to go into frontline services. So we've kept hearing from Nicola Willis and others that the frontline, they're going to get that money. We're going to see more in, you know, police, health, education. But until May 30th, we won't actually know what that looks like. So in the meantime, you've got ministers saying, look, this is all for a greater purpose, but not a lot of detail behind it. There's obviously a lot of people who will say, this is awful, this is outrageous, particularly in Wellington and Auckland, where a lot of these public servants are. Flip side, you're going to have people saying, this is happening everywhere in all sorts of industries, and this is just the way that the world is at the moment, and you're going to have to move on. Katie, you did a story this week. You tried to get some questions out of Nicola Willis around redundancies and what that might look like. What were the sort of unanswered questions there?
So went to Nicola Willis to ask about how, or she'd received any advice on the projected cost of redundancies. We worked out that each individual or the average redundancy in the public service is around $50,000. So if you add it up to the 3,000 jobs that have been, you know, axed already,
big
that's working out to be quite a big number. So I went to her and asked if she received any projected costs. She said that she hadn't. It was up to individual agencies. So I thought it was quite astonishing that she hadn't really asked for that figure, considering that will put huge pressure on those public agencies that are going to have to pay out that bill. Another unanswered question, and this was reported by Tova O'Brien and Stuff, was that Treasury hasn't provided advice on the flow-on effects of these public service cuts on the Wellington economy. So things like businesses here, hospitality, the property market, welfare and transport. Tova asked Nicola Willis why she hadn't, and she said the advice that she received is that government spending has risen dramatically, inflation is too high, etc., etc. So quite astonishing that there are kind of two major parts of this kind of puzzle here with really unanswered questions as to the flow-on effects and the total cost.
I'm interested in that. Let me be the devil's advocate here, because why should the government necessarily be thinking about, you know, the public service's role in propping up an economy like Wellington when it's got a big picture to look at? Is that the role of a government?
Well, I mean, interestingly, I think some of this work has, well, not work, some of the flow-on of it has already happened, because if you look at Wellington at the moment and you look at the number of people that work from home now, the post-COVID kind of impact, I think hospitality and a lot of those sorts of things that get impacted by the public service sort of ebbs and flows, a lot of that's already actually happened. And I think there have actually been economists who have talked about this, and the fact that you can't, there's not necessarily a direct sort of cause and effect that comes with, if you cut out the public service, well, then everything else is going to fall apart. There's a, you know, there's plenty of other factors going into that as well.
The other thing, just very quickly on the cuts, I'm interested in, this has started to come out too, as to whether the cuts are in the right places. And we won't know it until the budget. And one of the points someone, I think, made in a column this morning might have been Matthew Hooton, you know, that a lot of departments are simply cutting jobs that hadn't been filled, hundreds of them in some cases. But they may not necessarily be the right jobs to cut, but they're an easy, low-hanging fruit, if you like, because it doesn't, there's nobody assigned to that role.
Yeah, I think this is maybe the consequence of the government handing responsibility for, you know, these cuts to the government agencies. The chief executives of those agencies have essentially sole responsibility of choosing where the money that they have to save comes from within their agency. They're the ones who decide where the cuts are made. The government's kind of handed this over to them, passed the responsibility over to kind of free themselves up, I guess, of responsibility on that one.
Now, what have we got? Christopher Luxon, of course, going global. How do we think he's gone? I mean, quite a big trip for him. I mean, it sort of suits his personality, this one, doesn't it?
Oh, totally. I mean, this has been a real business trade type trip, which of course is, you know, Christopher Luxon in his happy environment. I think on the whole, he's done pretty well. There has been a little bit of diplomacy, political stuff. Of course there is when you're having these bilateral meetings, but for the most part, it's been around that sort of regional security stuff. He did have the complication of while he was in the air on the way over, they stopped in Cairns on the way over and of course found out what had happened with Iran over the weekend. That could have potentially derailed things a bit. But basically, those regional security lines, I think Christopher Luxon's kind of holding in a bit of a safe pattern on that, which is not surprising for the Prime Minister. I think you saw the same on trips with the likes of Chris Hipkins, Jacinda Ardern and John Key. Often it's the foreign ministers who kind of push things out a little bit with the nuance and the narrative, and you get the Prime Minister holding those lines. Christopher Luxon's done that with the diplomacy stuff, and he's done things a little bit differently too. He's with the business side of things. He's taken some of the business delegation into those bilateral meetings with world leaders. That's quite a different approach. That's very much Christopher Luxon wanting business leaders to hear firsthand what the issues are, how they might be able to work together and actually contribute to that too. So seeing that sort of corporate style, I guess, meeting the Prime Minister style on this trip with Christopher Luxon as well.
I also think that he has potentially come across as quite relaxed in the diplomacy space. I mean, this is his first kind of major foreign mission. He's, you know, faced questions all week about this kind of very tense global situation that we find ourselves in, and he seems quite at ease answering questions about it. I remember the first day he was asked whether or not he would be open to opening New Zealand airspace for Singapore to trial drones in, and he, you know, was willing to answer that question, whereas, you know, previously he could have kind of batted it away, but he seemed pretty willing to answer the question.
Yeah,
well, there's a lot of tricky questions when you think of the South China Sea and the diplomacy and the tightrope that is being walked by New Zealand, but so far you haven't seen any major gaffes. And a lot of world, you know, a lot of previous prime ministers have got into some very tricky territory on that stuff.
Oh yeah, it's an easy one to stuff up, that's for sure. And he hasn't so far. But I come back to the point of, I think he has very sort of specific advice and specific lines from MFAT, and he's not straying too far from them. Now that's a safe thing to do when you're on your first sort of big stage international mission, and when there are very live issues flying around in terms of, you know, the Indo-Pacific, the regional security, China, everything that's going on there. I mean, the last thing you want is to have sort of a diplomatic night.
The one area where they may have got a bit of a blindsided was AUKUS, because Labor has come out quite strongly and sort of suggested that through Winston Peters' visit to the US recently, that the government has sort of gone off and lurched further towards AUKUS than where they had previously been. Now, they deny that, don't they? They say, no, it's the same position as Labor's, but Labor does seem to be changing as well.
Yeah, look, I mean, you have had both US officials and Winston Peters talking out about the fact that this is not what other people are making it. This is not what the Helen Clarks, the Chris Hipkins, the David Parkers are saying that it is. They keep coming back to the fact that this remains an information gathering exercise, and that, you know, we're away from AUKUS partners or New Zealand agreeing to anything. So, you know, very different perspectives here, because if you listen to what Helen Clark and Bob Carr this morning are saying, you know, it's almost as if they're suggesting that the deal's been done and we're just waiting for the piece of paper to be signed. But real pushback from the government. Christopher Luxon as well, real pushback from him overseas about AUKUS.
The language in that statement, though, to be fair to Labor a little bit here, the language was a little bit stronger around the practicalities of potentially working with AUKUS.
The powerful reasons.
Yeah, the powerful reasons. So the language was a little different, wasn't
yeah
it?
So you did though have Helen Clark and others already pushing back on this before that statement came out, but I think that statement has definitely not helped the situation, because you did have that quote unquote powerful reasons to join. Winston Peters, of course, he came on the program and he pushed back on that.
He did.
And he said that no, this is still in the same realm that it was when Labor was in government. And, you know, stop kind of trying to make this out to be some bigger thing than it actually is. Katie, you were at that panel yesterday where we had Helen Clark and Rob. What were the more interesting things out of that?
Well, I was just going to make the point that I think it's important to make the difference between the two governments. I mean, under Labor, there were discussions, they were exploring this, and that was really clear. But we have seen, I guess, more enthusiasm towards AUKUS under the current government. I mean,
Leaning in, I think.
Yeah, I mean, 2 months after the government was formed, we had Winston Peters and Judith Collins in Melbourne with Richard Marles, the Australian Defence Minister, kind of giving authorisation for his officials to come to New Zealand to brief New Zealand officials. So there is, I guess, more energy towards this.
All right. Act. Very good. Thank you very much, Katie Scotcher, RNZ political reporter and RNZ's political editor. Joe Moyer.